Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And on behalf of the Dean and Chapter, a very warm welcome to the Lady Chapel, part of Westminster Abbey. If you've not been in here before, do take a moment or two to gaze at the wonderful ceiling. The chapel was commissioned by Henry VII, so this is, well, I would say it's the finest ceiling of all churches in England, possibly in Europe. The banners are the banners of the senior members of the Order of the Bath. And behind me, the bronze sort of cage that you can see behind or within that are the tombs of Henry VII and his wife, Elizabeth of York. Tonight we're very pleased to welcome Lord Neuberger as our interlocutor, and he will introduce our speakers shortly. A fascinating topic this evening. I hope there will be plenty of time for questions and comments at the end. We hope that you will make yourselves at home and free to ask what you will. Lord Neuberger, I hand over to you, and thank you very much indeed. Look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you very much indeed. Our distinguished panel this evening consists of Jean Seaton, the Professor of Media History and the BBC's official historian, and Gary Gibbon, the political editor of Channel 4 News. Their impressive biographies are set out in the paper on your chairs. We'll begin with each of us giving a short 5-minute presentation. I will then put a couple of questions to the speakers to kick things off. But we'll then ask you if you would like to put your questions. We'll end with a 2-minute wrap-up from me to ensure that I've been paying attention, and we should finish about 7:45. We hear a lot about human rights today, and there are few, if any, more important rights than freedom of expression. But like all rights, freedom of expression has its limits: incitement to violence, defamation, hate speech, and so on. And centrally for this evening's discussion, it also carries responsibilities. And many may think, just as freedom of expression is particularly precious when it comes to newspapers, television, radio, and the internet, so do those who produce the output on those media have a particular duty to be responsible. Observing any responsibility is important in itself, but it's also important, I suggest, because persistent failure to be responsible risks undermining the public's appreciation of the value of freedom of expression. Of course, responsibility does not mean being boring. On the contrary, some might say. At the very least, responsibility means being honest and accurate. But it by no means requires impartiality, which is what we are concerned with today. Impartiality is, of course, fundamental in my world, that of the judiciary. If judges cease to be impartial, then that's the beginning of the end for the rule of law. And once the rule of law breaks down, we may as well say goodbye to freedom of expression and all the other rights which we've come to appreciate in this country long before the Human Rights Convention was conceived. Now, it's much easier for a judge to be impartial than it is for the media. We don't have viewing figures or circulation figures to worry about, even in the Supreme Court, where we stream our hearings on our website. But some parts of the media, most obviously television, are required to tread the uneasy line between impartiality and popularity. Many parts of the media, especially newspapers, are not subject to any impartiality requirement, although they are subject to some rules. But those rules are more informal and more to do with protecting individuals. My colleague, Sir Brian Leveson, has famously written on the topic. And of course, the internet is something of a wild west in this connection. As any judge knows, and no doubt any broadcaster knows, perfect impartiality is impossible, if by impartiality you mean neutrality. Any self-respecting judge is aware of the influences of his or own background and conscious biases, and one does one's best when it comes to unconscious biases. The view a judge forms of a witness will be influenced by the judge's experience of people and life. And in a sense, most people would say quite right too. A judge who is wholly detached from ordinary life is not a judge most people would want to try their cases. And complete impartiality in the sense of complete neutrality in television news and current affairs or any other area involving the media is also impossible. That's not merely for the sort of reason I've mentioned, but also because, effectively by definition, there can be no such thing as a wholly impartial news broadcast. Which items you choose, what order you put them in, how long you give them, are all questions which involve judgment and discrimination. But for that very reason, it can be fairly said that any resultant program will display a lack of neutrality, a degree, some might say, of partiality. But that doesn't mean that broadcasters shouldn't strive to be fair, any more than judges shouldn't strive to be fair. The fact that perfect impartiality is unattainable does not mean that we should not try to be as fair as possible. Indeed, in the 21st century, with largely uncontrollable electronic systems of communications, with blogs, texts, tweets, chat forums, networking, websites and the like, many may think that impartiality in the traditional media is more important than it ever was. And in the longer run, may not it be true that self-interest and impartiality go together? If we are in an increasingly partisan and unreliable media world, may it not be that a justified reputation for fairness and impartiality will be actually valued by many people? So that's my halfpenny worth or tuppence halfpenny worth for 5 minutes. I now ask Gary Gibbon if he will go next. We're doing the opposite of ladies first.
Thank you very much indeed. And it is a great honour and pleasure to be here. I've always wanted to come to one of these seminars. Ever since about 6 o'clock one evening in the House of Lords, I discovered a member of the House of Lords on a critical vote, massive constitutional issue, slipping out the door. And avoiding this moment of real challenge. And I asked him where he was going to, and he said he was going to hide over here in one of these seminars. So maybe that's what someone else in here is doing tonight. I don't, in my job, confront real hazards or danger very often. But on the 30th of April 2002, I did. I descended the steps into a very dangerous fire hazard, Tony Benn's basement flat. Masses of archive, newspaper cuttings, diaries. And as ever, Tony Benn would always get his tape recorder out when I was about to record him. And on this occasion, he had a very particular gripe. He said, "Why is it that I have to look at you, Gary, when you're interviewing me, but when you address the people, you get to stare right in the lens?" He said, you're putting yourself up as God, he said, the ultimate judge. And in some ways, in some alarming ways, in our journalistic field, that is what we are trying to do. We are aiming for impartiality. We're hoping that we live up to the standards that have been set by law for us. But they're standards I passionately believe in. No doubt, many people would say, often failed to achieve, along with many of my colleagues, but which I think we desperately need, maybe even now more than ever. They have come under pressures, which Lord Neuberger referred to, political pressures, people like Tony Benn on the left forever saying that we are cutting up our packages or using the wrong interviewees or only using certain arguments, not going outside the consensus and the rest of it, and from the right as well. And we have particularly had that over Europe, and something no doubt we'll come back to. We now have a new pressure, which has been developing, intensified by technology, which is a commercial pressure. And there is no doubt that people are moving away from fixed television bulletins, us serving up a plate of news at a time of our choosing, and finding their news through very different sources. But I invite you to imagine, maybe you thought like me, that the referendum campaign that we've just lived through was one of the most shrill and unappetizing contests you've ever seen in our democracy. I invite you to imagine what that would have been like if all the people on one side had got all their news from one source that entirely reflected their opinions, and all the people on the other side had got a similar service catered for them. I would say close your eyes and imagine it, but you don't need to, because right now, if you look across the Atlantic, you are getting a flavour of exactly what that world is like. Market forces are driving people into silos, very carefully luring them in, and they are turning people into entrenched and polarized individuals. These channels that they watch don't give them a breadth of information, don't give them balance. They purposefully ignite so much indignation that people feel even angrier about any other source of information, and they are driven further and further and deeper into the cave. I think if we do away with impartiality in this country, and there have been pressures in the past, no doubt they'll come back, we are in danger of going deeper into that cave ourselves. There are enough things that divide us as a society without adding to them. This is a place where society, in bulletins, in a shared news system that is impartial or aspires to impartiality, this is a place, one of the few places left where the nation can come together and break bread. So I passionately believe in this system. There'll be no doubt many questions about whether we remotely maintain it. And I will end by telling you what Tony Benn did just after I spoke to him, because he said, I'm going to look into the camera, Gary, because I'm going to record something right now, he said, which is my obituary. And we complied, and happily it was quite a few years before his death, and turned the camera directly on him, and he stared into the camera, and he said, I'd like to thank my family and all the people who helped me through life and all the people who supported me in politics, and I hope I didn't give offence. And then he paused and he looked right into the camera and he said, and I'll check that on transmission. And you should check us and you should uphold us, but we should stick, I would say, to this very important goal. Thank you.
Well, I'm very grateful to be asked, and rather awed, because I'm in the presence of two great practitioners of impartiality. But I come from a discipline which may surprise you. I'm an academic. Academics don't really believe in impartiality because they believe that everybody comes with a viewpoint and everybody's views are prejudiced, as if that was the answer. Of course, everybody comes from a viewpoint and everybody's views are prejudiced and they are made. Our impartiality is the absolute, it seems to me, cornerstone of a democratic attempt to come together in a process to understand as closely as we can what is actually happening. And that seems to me something that's under real pressure now for a series of both business, technological, and then personality issues. There are two sort of traditions, really, of how it is that truth might something like truth. And we as social scientists or historians or newsmakers don't deal in the nice, crisp truth of a Steve Jones with biology, or it's not nice and simple truth in a way, though difficult to reach. It's a much more complicated, nuanced, human developing thing. One historian's view of an event will be reinterpreted by another historian's view of an event, quite often using the same documents. That's absolutely fine. They may both be on the way to a fully more fully nuanced view. But we have two, there are two competing views, it seems to me, about how this precious, precious public discussion of truth emerges. One of which is that truth is seen as, and indeed in that sense impartiality, emerges out of a competition. It's the Miltonian view of truth. Whoever knew truth put to the worse in a free and open encounter. That is the American tradition, that views will clash. And in some sense, there is a real belief that the strongest view will emerge. That seems to me actually a really damaging view for democracy. And we, on the whole, have had a different tradition, which has seen impartiality as a product of a dynamic and, frankly, lovely argument developed by people who learn and listen to each other and quite often encounter and listen to people they don't agree with. And that listening to people that you don't agree with nuances your argument and makes your argument stronger. You have to be able to encounter the strongest argument against it. That's basically the John Stuart Mill tradition, and in fact, that is one which has infused our institutions. The supposition here has been that broadcasters, because people were so worried about the immense power that broadcasting might have to propagandise people, would because of that fear, broadcasters have been held to something like impartiality. Impartiality is very difficult to arrive at, but there are a number of tools. There is balance. Balance isn't the same as impartiality, but it's jolly useful on the way. There's listening to alternative points of view, but in the end, you have to make a judgment. So impartiality is a process, I think, and indeed our broadcasters have exercised it, I think, at a formidable level. They've done it in news, but actually they've also, in a broader way, been required, but actually have done it over jokes as well. They've tried to balance Yes Minister with other kinds of views. So it's a kind of, it's something that suffused the whole system. So impartiality has been something that it seems to me holds the flood of democratic encounter open. And that's what I'm really interested in. Being a Democrat is about being concerned with minorities, not majorities. It's about listening to unacceptable, nasty views you don't agree with, as well as those that you do agree with. It's about bringing the power of the whole collective to look after everybody's interests, even though that requires a reallocation of the goods that we all value to put sometimes towards people we don't actually value very much at all. So democracy, it seems to me, requires something like impartiality in the system. Impartiality is now under huge pressure. As Nick said, the internet really has opened up a whole avenue of very partial points of view. What's more worrying is that it's very easy, whether you are an anorexic, frankly, or a jihadi, or somebody with very firm views about the European Union, fed, I might say, over years, to only partake of, encounter, go down the views of people that agree with you. And indeed, in addition to that, online in these communities, people will be very nice to you. They'll be very warm and embracing, whether you're a jihadi or an anorexic seeking to find those views. And that poses a real problem for impartiality, to which I have no answer, except that it just means that the battle lines are nastier, more urgent, more required. And the last thing I want to say is it is not that people don't like impartiality. There have been some situations, Nazi Germany, Russia now, where the public seems distanced from reality, quite happy, really, to have a very prejudiced view of reality. But usually, over history, people have been very hungry for something that tells their own story to them. And empirically, that is still the case, that if you look at the evidence, people really, and that the more people are educated, the more they want news that they make up their own minds about. So I want to argue, and we might go into that more, that impartiality is under the greatest strain I have ever seen, and I don't say that lightly. I mean, I think there is a real crisis, but we have to find ways of supporting it. And in people like Channel 4, we really need them to be incredibly ingenious in the selling of that precious thing, impartial news.
We've heard some very thought-provoking points being made, often of quite a general nature. I wanted to kick off by asking Gary perhaps more specific issues. One topic which will be an elephant in the chapel, if you can have elephants in the chapel, is the therefore might as well be mentioned, is impartiality in the context of the Brexit debate, which you referred to a short moment ago. Another one which I was going to ask you to link it to, which is slightly different, but is one which has been ongoing almost as long, perhaps not so intensely recently, is to do with global warming and issues of that sort. There, the issue may be rather different. Is it right, for instance, to give equal time to views when one of them appears to be a mainstream view and another isn't? With Brexit, the issue is slightly different, more intense in nature. And I wondered whether you had any thoughts on that.
Yes, I feel I'm in the dock. I don't know about anything else. The Brexit campaign was a very challenging one, and because there had been a background of particularly people who wanted Britain to come out of the European Union feeling that their side had not been heard over the years, had not been treated properly, had been treated like swivel-eyed loonies, I think is what they felt that was the treatment, and that they felt very strongly that the newsrooms of the major bulletins were probably Brexiteers were an endangered species in those rooms. There was very particular pressure on the broadcasters to balance. And I think Jean touched on this. There is a significant difference between balance, which is just can be just operating a stopwatch. And one of the channels actually did operate a stopwatch. And impartiality. Because this is not about abandoning scrutiny. It's not about treating all claims, and this ties in with your science point, as completely equal. It's about subjecting things to equal, rigorous scrutiny. And if something crumbles under scrutiny, then it should be seen to crumble under scrutiny. And I'm not sure in the Europe debate whether everything we did, well, I'm quite sure everything we did didn't measure up to that, but I know that there were, along the way, some particularly sort of painful moments. The one that stays in my mind, that really sticks out in the Europe debate, was when the Institute for Fiscal Studies produced a report which said that Brexit would cost us so much and damage growth in this certain way over time. And the official Leave campaign came back and said, oh, don't listen to them, they're just funded by the European Union. And in one bulletin I actually heard, I'm sorry to say on the BBC, probably for reasons of freshening things up, probably for reasons of balance, they led with the attack on the IFS even, before you'd even let people have the material to operate scrutiny. I hope that sort of touches on a sort of answer.
Very much.
Can I just say, it seems to me public service impartiality requires broadcasters not to leave the public in any doubt as to the decency of people who believe that the earth is flat and respect for their views, but in absolutely no doubt that in comparison to the scientists who for 2,000 years have demonstrated that the earth is round, that's got a different purchase. And that's impartiality is not a weak NIMBY thing, it's a very powerful tool. And it seems to me that the IFS case was a really terrifying example of a really great institution which has been built recently, a huge authority, just kind of treated as if it were Dominic Raab.
I was going to pick up a point which you made, Jean, which was about the difference between the USA and the UK. And, of course, in the UK, it isn't just a matter of publicly funded broadcast television services having to be impartial, but it's also the private ones, which is quite a contrast, I think, to anyone who watches Fox News, between Sky in the UK and Fox News in America. And I wondered if there was anything you wanted to say about that.
Thank goodness for a thing that newspapermen don't like called regulation, which is the thing that empowers journalists to do journalism. So Fox News, owned by exactly the same company that owns Sky, on the one you have a very... a thing that looks like a newspaper, really, to us, which is very partisan and very influential. And in Sky News, you have something which is held to standards of impartiality by regulation. So, and in my view, most journalists, but that this is just, isn't it more interesting probing and asking, not being the news? Fox News seeks to be the news. I suppose the other big contrast is, historically, American newspapers have had that great weight of the Second Amendment, of authority, of testing things. Anybody's on the end of a telephone, an American newspaper, where the fact checker phones you up for the fourth time and says, you know, can you, or different fact checker. Whereas in Britain, perhaps because of broadcasters, we've always said that the press could indeed be partisan. So that you're looking at slightly different machines. As we go forward, they're merged together in a new technological age. That's one of the problems. We haven't sorted how we deal with these issues properly.
You got any thoughts on that?
Well, it is a strange thing in America. When you look at the New York Times, it's a sort of the newspaper is the one that's desperately striving for some sort of balance. And it's not just, of course, Fox News. There's a left liberal CNN. Equivalent. It's dire. I use this analogy all the time about the impartial news being the water you can drink, and people need to know it's there. And my goodness, there are enough sugary and acid drinks out there. You really don't need to add to the supply.
I think that there's another really interesting issue, which is that we tend to think of news as being the thing we sort of take in through our eyes, as it were. Whereas it seems to me there's another bit of news, which is the really important thing, which is the news gathering, news assessing, editing. You know, foreign news is very expensive and really important in a globalised world. So it's also how those really important machines get going and ask their questions and bring us back evidence. So, and that they must also, as it were, test every regime they come across and test, you know, local government in Wales as much as they test, which, of course, is almost undone now, but as they test foreign dictators. It's a very seamless thing, in a way.
Mm. I'm going to throw questioning open to the floor now. Based on experience, even as distinguished an audience as this can start off being a little shy, and the questions come later. So I'm going to ask Becky Purvis if she would ask the first question. There's a microphone coming your way.
Hello? Yeah. Hi, I'm Becky Purvis. I work for the Royal Society, which is the UK's National Academy of Science. And I actually came clutching a question, but I think I've been scooped by Lord Neuberger on my question. I was going to ask you about whether broadcasters have a responsibility to distinguish highly probable assertions based on evidence from hypotheses based on limited evidence versus opinions, which I think you've just covered quite well. Now I get a bit of freedom to ask another one. I was actually listening to a documentary on Radio 4 last night, which was talking about the growth of talk radio. I just caught the last little bit, but looking at how that maybe was affecting the way the conversation was going in America in the lead up to the election. And I wondered, actually, if that's that different. They were talking about how, because the UK was different and impartiality, that the conversation was very different over here. But I wondered if it is actually that different, because as we've seen in the run-up to Brexit, we had the very, as you just talked about at the IFS, the conversation wasn't necessarily based on facts and impartiality. And I wondered, actually, because maybe the news media, is that the main way, the impartial news media, the main way most people are getting their information, they're now getting it through Facebook, through Twitter. Is there a need for impartiality in a broader way, or the news media to get out there more? Do we need impartiality in the way that Facebook and Twitter are pushing news out there?
The questions go to the absolute heart of the problems ahead, really, and the problems we've just lived through and are witnessing in America. To answer them probably in reverse order, I think the Brexit campaigns would argue that they didn't necessarily win it through national television. They feel that they neutralised some of the advantages that the other side had, the big barrage of government announcements and the rest of it, through national television. And they utilised their friends in the newspaper media, and they utilised the internet to give pump out very direct and grabby bits of polemic to their supporters and to feed them. So what those supporters didn't have was, and which we haven't gone down the road of quite as much as the Americans have here, is a tendency to get all their news, or a lot of their news, from Facebook. And that is an extraordinary phenomenon in America. And Facebook has algorithms which can make sure that if you're an 18-year-old, you'll be looking at a completely different version of the world and the news from your 70-year-old grandmother, who might have completely different political views. And you are seeing reflected back to you the thoughts you first started with. And we haven't necessarily gone down that route, but we are moving down that route. And you could say, well, what's the point of keeping impartiality in broadcasting then? Because it's all going to go that way. You could argue that. I just think if you've got something that's vaguely working, you should hold on to it for pity's sake. And who knows, maybe we won't go as deeply into the cave as others have.
I agree with all of that, but I just want to add one thing, which is that if you looked at Brexit, I mean, it wasn't just there were many, many, many issues, you know, all around here. I've been in many debates and arguments, you know. But if you just concentrate on the media, there is a long-term drip, 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 which we know affects how people see the world. And around Brexit, that drip had always been on one side. And you can't, if all prime ministers always go to Europe and extract a concession, rather like the last bit of meat from a lobster claw, and come back and claim they've got it. You can't suddenly ask the public to vote for something positively, leaving aside the ridiculousness. I think that... there's a longer-term issue about how people learn to discriminate between the media, where they take their messages. And that, as Gary said, I think is... We're on a cusp where that may all be getting rather more frighteningly bad, because the algorithms that deliver you on your Kindle, the books that supply the wants you already have, my Kindle's very confused. It doesn't know what to do. Those algorithms look neutral, but they are deeply dangerous, and they're controlled by other people. So giving you more of what you want feels lovely when it's spaghetti. It doesn't feel so good when it's your views. And that, we've really got, how we manage that is a real 20-year task, which we're on the foothills of, I think, really.
Thank you. Is Shazia Akhtar here?
Yes, sir.
Because you've been good enough to send in a question. I should say that the question is one which I haven't discussed it, but it may be it's a bit specific for a clear and simple answer to be given, but I'll leave it to you to ask the question and to the two panellists to answer it. So please ask your question.
Good evening. My question to the panel is that how fair do you think that the press regulator is in light of the recent decision regarding Kelvin McKenzie and Fatima Manji's broadcast assault? Thank you very much.
I think there's a danger I stray into. I let down the very standards I'm supposed to be proclaiming if I wade in on that one. But it's a very interesting case. But I don't think we were ever accused by him of breaching impartiality by having Fatima present the bulletin. But anyway, I think I'm going to say that's a wonderful question that begs many answers, but I'm not. Maybe someone else would like to chip in.
Well, it seemed to me it's very difficult to be continent around Kelvin McKenzie. But it seemed to me it was confusing faith with opinions, which is and the entire British settlement. Has actually been a very humane one in which faith is, I think, greatly respected. It's a very important part of our lives. So I just, it was part of the, so that Kelvin McKenzie, I mean, he's been nasty about an awful lot of other people. I wouldn't take it personally, is would be one thing I would say. But there is a, well, I would say that there was an alarming, a quite alarming nastiness about that is, that, you know, discussion doesn't say, you know, even impartiality doesn't stay stable. It moves to where it's licensed. So the middle of a discussion moves to where it's licensed. And perhaps I'm being, you know, perhaps it's the wrong time of the year. But I think there is a nastiness abroad, which is licensed at the moment, that we need to address really severely, while absolutely facing, absolutely admitting, absolutely looking at what people are really saying and what they're really thinking. I think you. So if we went back to the flat earth things, I think you, one of the roles of the media is in fact to make people feel that they're not silenced, that somehow that they have a voice, even if you don't agree with those voices. And I think that compact needs careful thinking. So I don't know if that's an answer, but to that very good question.
Question in the front row, two behind.
John, can I pick up Jean's last point about people who, and perhaps bring it back to Brexit, because one of the concerns about Brexit is that a lot of people felt their voice was not being heard, and maybe they joined what they saw as a protest vote, and maybe we'll see some of this in the United States as well. And I wonder whether this is something that the media should address. But more broadly on Brexit, it strikes me that the broadcasters treated the Brexit vote rather like they would treat the general election.
Yeah.
In other words, they decided that you had two parties and they should be given equal time. And I wonder whether the broadcasters, with the benefit of hindsight, feel that this was a mistake and that it wasn't right to give equal time to both sides, and whether they would do things differently now if this were ever to happen again, which I don't suppose it will. It's really how you achieve the enlightenment, which I feel a lot of people think they didn't get, despite all the huge amount of coverage. An awful lot of people on the day after said, oh, we didn't know it was going to mean this. We didn't expect that. And they, those who think it went the wrong way blame the broadcasters for not revealing to the protesters, the Brexiteers, if you like, what this was actually going to mean and what they were actually voting for. So I wonder what post-mortems have been going on in the broadcasting organisations, whether they feel that they handled it as in the only way they could, whether they feel that there were things they should have done and didn't do, and I suppose really whether it's all the fault of the broadcasters.
I don't know if a broadcaster would like to go first.
Which would imply the result was a wrong, perhaps. being impartial. Issue of equal time was one we were sort of touching on a bit earlier, and it can become a neurosis rather than a tool for explanation, and I would agree with you there. What my programme aspired to was sort of parity over a period. So, for instance, if I thought that it would be helpful to go off and do one film that looked at the views of Gisela Stuart or Hilary Benn, I went off and did that, and over time that would be balanced by another piece. And everybody knew the other piece was coming, and we kept an eye on the balance. But it's sometimes a helpful way of exploring things rather than having ding-dong and then reporter staring into camera in that way that annoyed Tony Benn, saying only time will tell. And I think all of this comes down to one of the issues at the back of the question as well, I think, which is, did we engage them enough with the arguments? Because I think you could flip that back to the voters and say, were they listening? Because there was actually quite a lot of content out there that was high class. I think one of the problems that we sometimes do, though, and I think I saw this, I've seen this across the broadcast media, is that we comfort ourselves, we did a fact check, we say. There's this thing that started in America. I think Channel 4 was the first to bring it over here, but it's now all over the place. And the problem with that is, and you no doubt the BBC will be doing fantastic amounts of self-flagellation, because they're very, very good, and there'll be bodies meeting even as we speak, discussing what their coverage and the rest of it. What was my point before? I was just.
Well, you balanced that your report. You didn't have to do it arithmetically.
Sorry, I got distracted by my own parenthesis. Then, the need to engage them. I was saying. Sorry, I do apologise. I'll come back to that.
I know the feeling.
There are legal requirements. But I thought during Brexit. But again, there's a short term and there's a long term answer. So there were legal requirements. But I thought that what happened really weirdly was that everything became politicised. So the IFS, which is in fact not political, it's a really good, authenticator of figures and views, absolutely built from built authority and responsibility. It suddenly, because its evidence came down on one side, it was then seen, it was kind of allocated to a political position which it didn't occupy. And I did hear one absolutely terrifying story about the BBC, which was that a reporter was told that the story on the exit side, he was producing insufficiently strong stories, so he was told to go away and get them stronger. Now that is really dangerous. That is really dangerous. But I think that again, there's a longer term problem, which is that there is a complete decay of local news in Britain, in a way that if you live in London, you don't really understand. But if you live in Hartlepool or Aberystwyth or the South Wales valleys, there used to be or Birmingham even, there used to be a really good local news that told you things that were going on. Those newspapers, in as far as they exist, have become really commodity. The news is all produced from Midlands hubs. So people don't see themselves they didn't say they're local communities, and there are a set of people who have done really not so well as the metropolitan elite, despite they've lived on European funds and things that have made their cities better. There are people who feel that their problems, their ways of life. Abervan is a very interesting place. Abervan had a terrible disaster. Now there's another disaster. There is no work in Abervan. So these stories have failed, I think, to get in the long term through, or at least people haven't felt they've got through. So that's another complicated answer. So I think that the decay in local understanding had a bite back at this point, because because people felt that they were distant. So I think that's a longer term problem that you can't expect a campaign to deal with. And if you go to the Facebook thing, there was a paradox, because the 2015 election was basically run by the people, and won by the people who ran, basically ran the centre of the Remain campaign. What they seem to have not calibrated, which is really interesting, was that in 2015 they had the right-wing press very much as an echo chamber. Come Remain, however dodgy, however many likes you were buying, because that's how you do it, you buy likes, it didn't work. So there's something, you might say, quite interesting about that, but it was there are lots of factors. So if only I knew. And I don't think the media are the only thing, but I think there's a longer media story which really concerns me, which is about the decay of people's own communities being reflected back to them in ways that they... so that they see themselves and they feel they have agency. And those people felt they were suddenly given agency and they would exercise it.
I've delved into my... I was about to talk about silos, and I think I left that bit of information in a silo. What I was talking about, the fact-check stuff, and how I think there is a risk that we just say, well, there's this fact-check over here, and it might be, I don't know, at 4:15 on News 24, or it might be on a website if you found... Fact-checking has got to permeate what we do, not in a New York Times quite so maybe neurotic way, but it's got to be there in everything we do. You can't just sort of farm it out and say, yeah, and after this piece, after I've said, you know, time will tell, you can go off and find out what it all really meant somewhere else. It's got to permeate this. This is where people are coming for their news, and you can't just hide the rigour somewhere else. And it's very telling as well, I think, that an awful lot of people, according to the data, who come to the main bulletins for their news, are the people who didn't have the benefit of such an education as many of us did, and the people who may come from less well-off backgrounds. And those people, in order to do their democratic duty, to be citizens, need better information, and they need proper rigour, and they need the tools to be citizens.
I'll take a few questions in a block so that a number of people can get their voice in. I promised the gentleman in the third row and then the two ladies in the front row.
I wanted to offer a slightly more, respectfully offer a slightly more nuanced view of science than Professor Seaton gave earlier on. In that there are often competing views and competing evidence, as I'm sure you know, and that can get very complicated for the media. And the classic example which has come up is obviously climate change, but there are others that come to mind like MMR and GM crops and so on. And I just wanted to get a sense from you about how the impartiality debate bears on science and whether there are sort of special considerations. Because, I mean, in a way, it should be easier, which I think is what you're alluding to, that there are certain things that we can basically regard as facts, and that can be the building block for debate. But actually, if you listen to some, organisations, even those facts become malleable and even destroyed.
And then, conveniently for the microphone, there are two ladies in the front row, if you ask your questions.
I'm interested in your take on people who quite intentionally opt out of conventional media consumption, even, you know, Facebook, and will use mainstream media, the term, as an insult. So perhaps in this country we've seen that among some people who support Jeremy Corbyn, perhaps in America some people who support Trump, who will deliberately choose to consume news and information separately because they don't trust what was set up to scrutinise the establishment is now perceived as being part of that.
We have been discussing a lot of crises about media, about social media, about democracy. My question is, who will be responsible to reverse the situation, and in what way? This might be large. You can just answer me in terms of, do you think the future is optimistic? It's okay.
That's three quite sort of different questions, but I don't know whether, Jean, you'd like to start off answering.
If I implied that science was simple, I really apologise. But the examples you brought, which was MMR, which the media catastrophically, you know, there are children out there who... really ill, because the media went with what it thought was the anti-establishment view. So I think one answer to that, but it's not an easy one, is that you need journalists who are peculiarly expert in what they deal with. You need better informed journalism. I have to tell you that we haven't talked about money. I mean, the financial basis of journalism is catastrophically disappearing as we talk about it. So whether we will, and whether professionals, lawyers have already tried to, I think, have really moved on this, and whether scientists will produce blogs that are, you know, that get purchase, is a, you know, whether professionals will occupy that territory. So that's, I'm apologising, but nevertheless, in a way, we need people who can adjudicate what the scientists do from an informed position. Somebody like Joshua talks about the law, so he's informed, he knows about it, he's likely to make interesting observations. Yes, if you listen to talk radio in America, the entire narrative of talk radio is about the liberal media. I mean, actually, and there's a Corbyn site called Canary, which is all about, it's media studies 101, it drives you mad, you know, it's always decomposing the... I think we have to be very careful about that. I go now a bit for the Foreign Office to India and Pakistan, both of which have very lively media. The Pakistani media is very lively, but almost never tells you the truth. It becomes then very difficult to have a discussion about reality. It's really interesting. People have very viewed in the head. And thirdly to you, the Enlightenment is the greatest thing that we live in. It means the lights turn on. It means we have the rule of law. It means we have impartiality. I think we have to battle everywhere for those values. So I'm optimistic, and your generation is actually likely to want truths and to be more versatile, certainly than my generation, at arriving at new ways. But I think we have to go on believing in these broadcasters, because they're one of our instruments. They're one of our, in Britain, they're one of our real instruments.
Before turning to Gary, I'm going to ask for a few more questions, and then he can pick up some. The gentleman at the end of the row, four rows from the back.
Or prejudice, because we're looking at this in a very top-down way. Yeah. We're talking about how the media can be regulated. Most of the people will seek out prejudice sites if they want to seek them out, just why we have probably our own personal choices of newspaper. But from teenagers coming through, do they have any insight into how the educational establishment is actually training them?
And then behind you, perhaps you would hand the microphone to them. Thank you so much.
The US election has been given vast coverage. However, there have been several major political events in Europe, such as the Lithuanian election, 250 days of no government in Spain, the unprecedented second ungluing of the Austrian presidential election. Does this represent an impartial selection of news?
And then somebody behind you, perhaps you just pass it to him. And then
basically, what I want to say in regards to the Brexit campaign, I believe that, you know, when it came to the people who started accusing the people who were and hold on a minute, I am an immigrant living in Britain. I do not believe in racism because I know what racism really does to people. But they were going all over London, all over Britain, and accusing the pro of being racist. I believe
thank you very much. Gary, there's quite a lot of questions, particularly there were three before, but...
Quite diverse, yeah. Jeremy Corbyn, there is an enormous antipathy towards MSM, as they call it, in their circles, mainstream media, and there is a lot of Twitter activity, a lot of websites that the people have set up are enthusiastic Corbyn supporters, and there is resistance right at the top of the Labour leadership now to the mainstream media. I was on a train a couple of weeks ago and on the way to Brussels, and Jeremy Corbyn got in the seat behind me and we reintroduced ourselves, but it's not often we meet. Jeremy Corbyn, this is not exclusive to Labour, I mean, party leaders all over the place don't like subjecting themselves to lengthy interviews, but Jeremy Corbyn has a particular resistance to it because they think they'll be done over by even Channel 4 News. And in a different context, The Guardian, I think, felt that there was this resistance to news from other news that the Corbyn supporters didn't like, and they saw an awful lot of feedback coming in their direction when they criticised Jeremy Corbyn, and some people would argue you can see a little bit of a tweak in their coverage of Labour issues since. There was an issue about touched a second ago on the silos that everyone is in, and I just wanted to mention another thing which makes this impartial news bulletin an even more important sort of gathering place for breaking the bread. If you look at America, not only are people watching different bulletins, not only are they, if they're not watching bulletins, getting all their news from a website with algorithms, they're living in the same places as well. There is much, much more residential silos happening, and I think you can begin to see some tendencies like that here, but you see it big time in America in the data, and people look around for whether this looks like the sort of area I'll like that isn't too bohemian or has a rush hour on a Sunday morning because the churches are so well attended or whatever it is. There are so many forces like that that are setting us apart, and that's another reason why I think we should have this lunch table that we come to, or dinner table at 7 o'clock, if I can persuade you to come to that. And I think I'm in danger of missing some of the other points, but what crisis, the crisis, how do we turn it round? I think that's a very big question. And it depends how you what to define the crisis as, but if you define it as...
Who is responsible and have the ability?
You're responsible.
I think we all are.
But
that's why we come together. And this is one of the things, I think, and I'm in danger of completely straying off the subject here, but it's one of the reasons why when democracy works, it works because people come together and realise that you have to compromise, and that political compromise is part of progress, and its pace can sometimes be glacial. It's not instant, like flicking on a television or going on your phone or whatever it is, but all those processes and those you need to be educated. We all need to be re-educated into those processes and realise that we only achieve when we come together doing things like that, which I think brings us back to the point that's very brilliantly been made over there, which is how on earth do we equip people in this age of extraordinary pace of change for if they are going to go to those sources of information, for pity's sake, let's make sure that we give them the rigour to know what they're looking at and process it properly and be good citizens.
Lady in the second row.
One of the remits of public service broadcasting is education, and something which I very much value your comments on, which is not unlinked to the silos, the algorithms, the lack of courage in some young people to explore beyond a safe space, is this question of safe space at university. That worries me enormously. And I think perhaps if 48% of 18-year-olds are attending university, is this not something which... the factual, the educational, the ability to learn how to balance, to learn how to listen to an opposing view, is there a duty almost to hold back this wave of silos, if you like? Could you comment on the related task of social media, public service media, and education?
There's a man there in the fourth row from the back, I think. He's put his hand up. Yep, that's him.
Hi, so this question does touch on the elephant in the Lady Chapel, but also on other topics brought up, like climate change. So would the panel agree that impartiality rests not just with how something is said, but with how often something is said? And if you were to agree with that, that that could represent a more subtle lack of impartiality with a more challenging connection to freedom of speech and media responsibility as a whole.
Can I say something about safe spaces?
Yes, of course.
Which is just, I find the whole safe space argument in universities astonishing and terrifying. Because, of course, George Eliot might upset you, and I hope that Sylvia Plath does too, and it seems to me extremely unlikely that you could read about the causes of the First World War, let alone, I've just been to Ypres, the First World War, without being upset. So being upset seems to me emotionally, educationally, absolutely at the heart of education and dealing with that upset. And the notion, of course I understand that that you have to within a classroom, and that's a quite difficult thing these days perhaps, make a place where arguments can be put and people feel comfortable and you elicit, you know, you feel the air. But the notion that young people are throwing, such privileged young people are denying that argument seems to me absolutely astonishing. And you can say I'm gobsmacked, and I think that the only way to deal with it is to, so at my university I propose we have a series of platforms. You know, if you want to have somebody that says transgender is, their argument, my chemistry and surgery might not be the only allowable solution to something, then let's do it. So I think that we have to be very robust, but you have to understand that there are real penalties around those kinds of discussions. So I think that that is certainly, as it were, the conditions under which you have discussions.
Well, slightly straying off the topic, I suppose. It's a very important subject.
But, I mean, they are related.
They are related.
Could I say something it prompts me to think about, though, which brings us a bit back?
It's just I feel very passionate.
No, I was listening to Chris Patton, looking back, who's going to faint with anger, talking about it the other day. But it made me think about political correctness in the media and how I think if we look back in striving to be impartial and also true to the spirit of a liberal society, and working out collectively as a broadcast media where we thought the centre of gravity was in our country, I think it is probably fair to say we got immigration very, very wrong.
Yeah.
And if we look back on our record, we were part of the sort of omerta, the way you just didn't dare to speak about the subject, and people who did were automatically tainted. And it didn't matter how they were coming to the subject sometimes. You saw a little bit of when David Goodhart came in with Prospector, that you could still hear people sort of attacking him quite virulently.
David Goodhart, I'm a fantastic fan of. You can go out anywhere in London and people will attack him for raising a humane argument, actually.
But I think we, the broadcast media, probably snuffed the subject out for a long period. And that, I think, is one of the things I'd talk about as a sort of classic mistake that we've made. Trying to be impartial and trying to be true to some other principles and getting it wrong.
What about the, not merely how much time you give, but how loud you shout, and the interrelationship with freedom of speech and the freedom of expression and impartiality?
Yeah, I wasn't quite, forgive me, I wasn't quite clear at the point you were, what sort of point you're making there. It was my fault, I do apologise.
I think it's something that Jean brought up in terms of in connection with the Brexit issue.
And it comes back as well to our power as the people who edit things and choose whether to allow someone to say the same thing again and again, our choice of whether we put that on the top of a bulletin or say, well, hang on, they've been saying that for days, why don't we not even run it today? I think you saw it happen a bit, and sometimes it can happen because where the main opposition party should be, there are empty seats. And I think that happened a bit in 2010 when Labour went off and had a leadership contest, yep. And David Cameron decided to use that moment to monster their economic record. I think it was happening a bit post-Brexit, in that the Remainers hadn't organised themselves, seemed to be asleep, and then suddenly stirred about a couple of weeks ago in the House of Commons debate, and since we've heard more and more from them, but it's still an inchoate thing. And that can sometimes be the reason why one message dominates.
I mean, broadcasters under impartiality rules find it very difficult if there isn't an opposition they can, as it were, put on air, or historically, if you looked at something like Northern Ireland, broadcasters had to somehow sometimes be the opposition, and it's a very uncomfortable place, and it tends to get you into trouble, so it's not surprising. So if the opposition doesn't manifest itself in a way that is easier for you to put on, then it looks like you're making the case for the opposition, isn't that?
And then that's true, and then the other thing we sometimes do is just simply divide the party in power and just treat that as an opposition.
Yeah.
I think there are plenty of periods we've done that, and we may just be in one now.
Well, I think probably we've come to a convenient point where we should end, because this has been very stimulating. I suspect there are a number of more questions, but that's the right way it should be. Well, there should be questions waiting rather than trying to draw questions like teeth. But first of all, thank you all very much for your questions, which have been very interesting and very much to the point. Some of the questions have been answered more fully than others, but that's inevitable when one takes questions in batches. The questions themselves have contributed to the discussion as well as the answers. I'm sure that you'd particularly like to thank the two principal speakers for their very interesting contributions, which has certainly told me a lot of things that I hadn't thought about. The discussion has strayed from time to time, as is appropriate. But when I mentioned Brexit, I didn't realise it would form quite as much of the discussion as it has done, and that was a bit naive of me. It is very much a highly topical, highly potentially controversial issue, and it's an issue which does highlight many of the points which have been raised in the questions and have been raised in the answers. But the questions and the answers have travelled in many other directions as well. And certainly, I wonder in 20 years, when this discussion and these points are looked at, how much we will have moved on. Newspaper circulation is declining, as we all know. Local newspapers, as Jean said in particular, are suffering very greatly. The internet is on the rise. And the world in 20 years may be very different from what it is now, but what I think is impressive about the questions and the answers is that we are preparing and are aware for and are aware of many of the problems, the question about how we prepare the young, the question, the concern about reinforcement, the question about IPSO, the question about how we try and improve matters and control things, all show that we are very aware of what's going on. If I might end with my world, I'm quite interested in the argument that you should be very fair about giving people equal amounts of time because everybody wants more time. I have one colleague in the audience, and I expect that this will strike a chord with him. I think judges tend to be more impressed when a barrister asks for an hour rather than for 4 hours. In a way, it shows great confidence in your case and great ability to put it across. But when your lawyer's talking to lawyers, it may be rather different from when you're a politician or scientist or someone else talking to the public. But let me end by asking you to thank the two speakers, Jean Seaton and Gary Gibbon, for their very interesting and stimulating contributions.